Hello, and welcome to Fidelity Connects, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. How could the 2020 U.S. election affect financial markets? Fidelity's panel of experts, portfolio manager Jeff Moore, sector strategist Denise Chisholm, and Jim Fibio, Senior Vice President of Government Relations, join host Pamela Ritchie to share their thoughts as markets brace for an unpredictable election campaign. They share their insights on different election scenarios, the potential volatility before and after the election, as well as the impact on the Canadian dollar and the tech sector. Commentary surrounding COVID-19 and financial markets is frequently changing. Today's podcast was recorded on September 9th, 2020. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
Jim, Jeff, and Denise, welcome to all of you today.
Thanks.
Jim, if we could begin with you and have you set the context for us, a little bit of the landscape of sort of the 1-2-3s of what we need to be watching in Washington as we approach the presidential election.
Sure, Pamela. And thanks, everyone, for having me. I guess I would start with the fact that Congress has just returned to Washington. And I think the focus right now is on the next phase of CARES Act or COVID relief. I'm calling it CARES 2.0 for shorthand. And I think the Senate this week will try and seem they'll try to move a skinny package, maybe in the $300 to $500 billion range to extend unemployment insurance through the end of the year, essentially. We don't think that will pass. We think it will be a messaging vote, probably to set the floor for negotiations. If you recall, earlier in the summer, the House of Representatives passed the $3 trillion HEROES package. I think that shows the House and the Senate are still a far bit apart. And so negotiations will continue, and I think we'll see a lot of messaging heading towards Election Day. With that said, we're looking at September 30th as the end of the budget funding deadline for Washington. And so they'll need to extend appropriations. We expect to see a short-term extension, probably till some point after the election when Congress will roll up its sleeves and figure out what the longer-term path is. Might depend on the election outcome.
Jim, any chance of a shutdown in D.C. at all, a shutdown of government? I mean, would it get to that point or probably not?
I would say you can never say never with this crew, but I would say highly unlikely. I think both folks want to show they can govern and Washington can function ahead of Election Day. So I would put the tail risk at that is pretty minimal. The other thing, obviously, is the election looming. We're inside of 60 days. And, I was looking at the 538 numbers this morning, and they run these simulations, and they've got Biden winning 74 out of 100 times and Trump winning 25 out of 100 times, and I think one tie in there. So, there's a greater likelihood Biden wins, but a 25% chance of Trump winning means he still could prevail. We've all seen the six swing state polls tighten a bit post-Labor Day here. And then probably two new states in play, looking at Georgia and Minnesota, as both camps look at different electoral paths to potential victory. And what I would say is when you say, just to understand the 538 polls, and looking at Georgia, 538 says Biden, Trump has a 67 out of 100 wins on a simulation, whereas Biden wins 33 out of 100, and they count that as Trump having a slight advantage. So if you're looking at 70-30 there and they characterize that as a slight advantage, how much of an advantage is it really for Biden in the other simulations they're running?
It's fascinating. And I want to come back to Jim to ask a little bit more about, as we edge closer, how does it then all come together? I'll bring in Jeff Moore. Jeff, tell us a little bit as we march towards this date in November, the types of scenarios that you are you're obviously working with on the way to the election.
Yeah, sure. So the hard thing is Jim's just give you 70-30, right? The problem is on November 4th, it's going to be 100-0 for somebody, 100% zero. That means stuff that isn't priced in will be priced in, and maybe things that we're getting priced in won't get priced in, so to speak. So what we run, instead of making forecasts, we run a lot of scenarios, say, are there some big scenarios that if this happened would lead to massive price discovery, which is code and bonds for losing money. And so what we're focused on is sector by sector, trying to figure out what would be the most impacted on November 4th and going forward. And could we position our portfolio today for clients so that they can benefit if a surprise happens? Because remember, 70-30 sounds good, but we know it's going to be 100-0 at some point.
Well, Jeff, and let's just go back to the last election, which for many was a huge surprise. How did you do the scenario work on that one? How did that give?
Well, if you remember, we have a 5-step process in Merrimack, and step one is always macro. And one of the things we did is we spent a lot of time with not just our quants, but our macro team in 2016. And it was pretty certain, if you looked at the 538 polls, and Jim will have more detail than I will on that, that it was going to be a President Clinton. Okay, and that's what I thought was going to happen, because that's what the polls were saying. But what we were able to do is put together some trades for our clients if there was a President Trump. And one of the things we early on feared is that a President Trump would run away from some of the sort of grandiose things he does, a pretty orthodox Republican agenda, cut tax, cut regulation, axis of evil. And so we were able to play off of those. And when it was clear that it was President Trump, it was risk on, and we had positioned the portfolio that way.
Interesting. Denise, I'd like to just ask you to sort of bring us up to date on how elections tend to, you know, impact the markets historically, and maybe even just more recent history. How do these presidential elections hit markets?
Sure. I think most investors know that there's something called an election wave or an election cycle in terms of market returns. So when you look way back to the 1930s and you aggregate all the data, you say the last 2 years of a president's term tend to be above average returns, and the first 2 years tend to be below average. The theory behind that is it takes a little while for the president to get his agenda through, and then the last 2 years of that presidency really tend to be stimulus driven in terms of re-election, increasing re-election odds. So it's important to understand that as a backdrop, but I think history can suggest when things change. And what you've seen over the last 15 years is those correlations drop and drop precipitously. And the reason for that is, I think, potentially twofold, and I'll talk a little bit about each one. One is that the market increasingly discounts this news. Jeff was talking about this a little. I think at the broader market level, you see that more and more. And I think it's important for investors to understand this level of fear and uncertainty is better correlated with better forward returns of the market than not. So the more uncertain the election, the more likely it is whatever outcomes generated, a fog can potentially be lifted, and that can actually generate more positive returns in the market. So that's one thing I think people need to keep in mind, that election might not be the dominant univariate issue that we need to tackle. The second thing that you've seen in sort of the last 15 years is that there might be another corollary driver, and that corollary driver tends to be the economy. Starting points of that matter. So we're just seeing a turn in earnings growth and inflection from that, and you might see that be the dominant variable. So as much as we want to be laser focused on the elections, I do think it's important for broader level investors to take a step back and think about how that really relates to all the other variables going on, and it not being the single influential factor to bet your portfolio.
It's fascinating. Jim, I want to ask you what is the wild card if things change and therefore we are talking about a President Biden? What could be the biggest change, but something that we don't really see coming?
So I think one thing to be watching is just how progressive would a Biden administration be? We've seen the push and pull between the progressive and moderate wing, and Biden has certainly pivoted to the more moderate stance for the general election. And and maybe more to his true roots. I think there will be a tremendous amount of pressure from the progressives to do things like get rid of the filibuster in the Senate. So if there's a, as we've done our scenario planning, we've actually forecast that a lot of the close Senate races will likely go the same way as the presidential race in that state. So I think a Biden administration likely brings a Democratic Senate. If Chuck Schumer is under so much pressure to get rid of that filibuster, we could see a very broad agenda push through, from tax policy to healthcare to environmental, through the legislative channels. The thing that we're tracking also is the agencies, and we saw in the prior administration and this administration the use of unilateral actions through the Department of Labor, the Securities Exchange Commission, Environmental Protection Agency, for very aggressive and fast action, and a lot of the pendulum continues to swing in this sort of deregulatory phase now, and we could see that re-regulation emerge looking ahead. So I think we're going to be trying to keep tabs on multiple fronts, from the environment to financial regulations to tax policy. And the other thing that's really crept in here, and no one's really talking about it, it's a proposal that Elizabeth Warren put out a while back called Accountable Capitalism. We saw the Business Roundtable in the U.S. actually come out and talk about stakeholders beyond shareholders. And if the Democratic Party really wanted to advance a broad agenda, they could turn to that as an initial initiative, because it would give the government more of a voice within corporate entities that the U.S. isn't really used to, and might actually set the stage for them to advance their broader policy agenda. So something we're keeping an eye on that.
Yeah. And actually, Jeff, I'll ask you to just sort of add. So to an extent, with a Trump presidency, we, as always with the incumbent, you have some sense of what you're getting. What are the things that we know and don't know about a potential Biden presidency that you're modeling for?
Yeah, so I think that's the right way to look at it. So a President Trump, market has a book on him, a data book, right? So any time series models you're running in the market, kind of know his reaction function. What's different here is, if it's a President Biden, what's the reaction function to a lot of different pushes and pulls? And Jim hit it very well when he was pointing out that, the progressive part of the party is going to try to tilt him one way. And depending on who President Biden puts in play, so his secretary of this or secretary of that, how aggressive the agenda is, a lot of sectors could be sort of vulnerable here, or benefit, I guess, potentially. But, and we would say that the sector that is probably most in the crosshairs right now is oil and gas in one way or another, partly because of the Green New Deal, even though candidate Biden's trying to walk that back, you're not really sure where that line is going to be. And so for us as investors, it is going to be an interesting time, because if it's a President Biden, then there's going to be a lot of other calculus. And I can imagine all of our clients on the phone here watching, TV every day, saying, okay, what did they say on this? Oh, and waiting on pins and needles for new sort of government agendas and new government regulation and new government prognostications.
And I mean, do you look, I know that you've spoken before about, for instance, I mean, there's lots of discussion about states needing more money, cities needing more money. I mean, does that work one way or the other in terms of investments from a Biden versus Trump perspective?
Yeah, so right now, if you said, other than small business, what group's been hit the hardest? It would definitely be states and local governments. In fact, the same thing in Canada, right, too, but states and local governments. And if you get a President Trump, it's not going to be as likely that you get a full-scale agenda that helps states and local governments out of their problems. They might get something, infrastructure, but that would maybe be the end of it. Whereas a President Biden, you can imagine a lot more positive outcomes for things like the state of Illinois, city of Chicago, that have been really hard hit and really didn't have a lot of financial flexibility running into this and could use some support in 2020. So, thinking about our investors, we'll be watching to see who the winners and losers will be on the other side, depending on who goes 100-0.
And you've got the depth of research to be watching this with sort of eagle eyes. Denise, is just picking up on something that Jeff said there. He talked about sort of this Green Deal that's in the background, but also coming to the forefront. I mean, do environmental, how does sort of stocks related to the environmental sector, I don't know if we can call it that, but how do they do in either scenario?
Yeah, I think it's interesting when you talk about market as a discounting mechanism, it is important to think about that. And we saw that both ways. Let's talk about financials after the great financial crisis. Regulation significantly affected that sector, right? So we can definitely see the impact of regulations on a go-forward basis of potential earnings and returns. Contrast that with healthcare, which was reformed in right after the 1992 election, or was attempted to be reformed and sort of pushed through in 1993. That was actually the point at which healthcare stocks bottomed, right? So I think there is always this potential for that fog to be lifted, and we need to understand it in that scenario. And just taking a step back, you see that oftentimes with taxes. So taxes have gone up, either corporate, personal, or capital gains, about 10% of the time in history. We can look to see what the market did. And oddly, in counterintuitive odds actually are, it gives higher than average returns and with a higher odds of the market advance during the years that actually taxes go up. And the reason for that is not that taxes are a good thing to the market. It's that more often than not, there is stimulus as an offset. So I think for any sector where you're considering that, you have to think about not only the cost of whatever it's regulation or increased taxes, but the potential benefits that may come to that sector as well, because the market tends to look at many things as one-time events where spending can actually have a higher multiple effect. So I think that that's important to consider, that there are some offsets. And even for the oil and gas sector, when you look over broad periods of time, the two times that you wanted to own the oil and gas sector historically were when it's cheap on all valuation levels. We are certainly not there because given they have no earnings. And we weren't there this entire cycle. As much as it was cheap on book, it was not cheap on any earnings-based measure. The second time where you have above average odds, and by above average, I mean 80% odds, is when you see demand decline. So you tend to look through to the other side to that rebound. So that could be the potential offset for that oil and gas sector that investors need to keep their eye on, despite the headwinds of a new Green Deal.
That is fascinating. Jim, a number of questions coming in right now from advisors who are on this broadcast with us right now, and they have to do with a lack of clarity around who wins the day of the election, and be that, and I know that it, so how do you crack that one? I mean, the questions are to do with volatility on either side, coming out of the fact that here we are 3 days, we don't know who the winner is, or it looks like it's one, but then it's not in the streak. I mean, how do you see this happening?
So, you know, if you look at the primaries in New York, it obviously took them a long time to figure out who are the winner of some of those New York primary races in a very populous state. And so with mail-in ballots and a lot fewer folks maybe going to the polls because of COVID, it could take a while to count. I think we'll be able to figure it out. There is that tail risk. You know, the backup plan is that the Speaker of the House, if we do not have a declared winner by January 20th, the Speaker of the House would become the acting president. But I don't think it'll get that far. I do think we might have to be patient for maybe days, weeks. I know both teams are geared up with lawyers to look at the validity of ballots if it's a super close election. So let's watch the polling as it gets closer. If it looks like it's, you know, a significant lead for one side or the other, I think that risk is mitigated. The other thing is a lot of ballots have already been mailed. So a lot of folks voting by mail are going to be able to vote, you know, even before the first debate, which is September 29th. And you know, it won't necessarily only be waiting for like the overseas absentee ballots. So we're going to have to all watch this one together, but it is something to keep an eye on.
I feel like there are sleepless nights ahead for everyone here. Jim, Jeff, just pick up on what Jeff said, and also Denise talking about fog lifting, usually when we come to the actual winner. Where is the volatility here? Is it before? Is it after? As Denise said, when the fog lifts, maybe there's less volatility. How do you look at this? Where are the opportunities?
Yeah, so there's two types of volatility. I think there's the volatility before the election is an uncertainty volatility. This is the one Denise really picked up on. I think she's right there. And then there's the volatility after the election. And let's assume it's a clean election and we know who's the winner. It's not like the conservatives in Canada, where they were trying to do their little vote and it took 12 hours extra. As you can see the issues, right? The technologies, there's going to be some issues potentially. But let's assume it's good. The volatility afterwards is going to be really along sector and policy lines. It's going to be how big's the tax increase? How fast? Who gets impacted? Will there be uncertainty towards business? Like Jim said, very big change would be starting to inject the government into corporate boardrooms in some way. That would be potentially a headwind to things. So there's a lot post that is going to be sector and really important, and we'll be spending a lot of time on that. On the pre-election volatility, it happens as the odds move around some. But you know, our team right now is pretty calm about the fact that we've had elections in Canadian US history forever, and it's not that big a deal. And I know we're all on pins and needles and we all have our own sort of political leanings one way or another. But away from that, as an investor, we kind of think you're still in the world where you get the normal pullbacks in the market. We talked about this earlier offline. You know, a 10% pullback is something that the quants will tell you happens on a regular basis. Like it happens annually, plus minus. And you get bigger.
We were talking on Wednesday and you mentioned that, you know, probably due for about a 10% pullback in equity market. And then lo and behold, Thursday came. So
and it's just the quants, our quants say that every 8 months, you're kind of starting to get due for a 10% pullback in stocks. And that's just history. It doesn't mean it's every 8 months, okay? It's not a forecast. It just says you should be starting to get ready for that. And so we got the pullback. And so I'm not sure how much of the pullback had anything to do with the election, stimulus, just valuations. It could be tax planning, people taking gains. But post-election, that's when this gets, I think, really real. And where for a lot of clients, now you're talking about locking in losses or gains. Right. Where till from here, nothing's sort of set in stone.
Okay, well, to just go into that on the capital gains front, because I mean, there are all kinds of people sitting on capital gains right now. There must be some concerns.
Yeah, so if you think about it, from March onwards, if you bought stocks, especially in some of the sectors like technology, you're probably sitting on big, big capital gains. And the fact is, you're kind of waiting to get by the short-term capital gains tax, but you kind of, if you look forward, the question you have for yourself is, do you want to pay President Trump taxes in 2021 or President Biden taxes, right? And so for a lot of clients, I can imagine as they get past the short-term capital gain window, they'll be starting to think through, do I reset my cost basis now or later? And that could be a little bit of volatility. For some people, they may just wait till November 4th, say, okay, now I know, and I'll see where things are there. But taxes will be a factor, at least short-term, for a lot of clients.
Okay. Denise, I know that in the past you have done a lot of research into whether tariffs, the discussion of tariffs, trade is obviously a broader topic, but tariffs, one piece of that trade relationship. Tariffs sometimes don't have as big of effect through history as we think. There's a lot of rhetoric around tariffs right now. Which parts do we need to pay attention to?
Yeah, in some ways it goes back to that historical analysis that the market is more often than not a discounting mechanism. So when we talked about it before in terms of the Trump presidency and tariffs, you could even proxy it versus global trade. We have a nominal trade series going back to the 1950s. And if you said that you had perfect foresight as an investor and knew that global trade was going to contract and you could quartile it out in terms of either those contractions or the best global trade environment, what you actually saw was a negative correlation with market returns, right? So you see that typical univariate analysis constantly challenging your assumptions to say either the market discounts in advance, receives stimulus to offset it, or there's another variable like an earnings recovery. And that tends to be the variable that is more likely than not the actual offset that tends to be dominant. So as much as we want to focus on tariffs and global trade, I think that when you look back throughout history, I think you have to acknowledge the fact that it hasn't been a predictive or dominant variable. So when I look at the market, I tend to think more in terms of predictive and dominant variables. And the two that I see currently are the earnings growth turn and the trajectory there, and more importantly, the dislocations that I see in the market. And by dislocations, I mean the valuation spreads. So a large gap between the highest valued stocks in the market and the lowest valued stocks. So we see it every recession, I would say, or every cycle where investors sell whatever they're afraid of and buy whatever they think is safe. The names change every cycle, but the valuation spreads do widen the same way in every cycle. And even at the low in March, what we got to was 75% of the way through what we saw in 2009 from a spread perspective. It took 18 months to get what we did in a month, which I think gives you some perspective on the rally. And despite the fact that I think from the bottom, the NASDAQ's up 80%, and I think the S&P's up, I didn't check today, but in the high 50s or maybe mid 50s, what you see is those valuation spreads are still wider than they are normally. So there is still levels of fear in the market, which I think that might be the dominant factor with that earnings recovery to push the market higher despite the election and despite tariffs or trade uncertainties, given that we'll see that going out the risk spectrum on the recovery.
Valuations gaps are still there. Okay, fascinating for what's going on right now. Jim, there's a great question about the virus. I couldn't have written it better here coming in from an advisor. Is getting COVID-19 under control the most important aspect for the health of the economy and thus a candidate?
Which candidate? Well, look, I think there's got to be some balancing act, right? As you look at this, and I think both candidates are trying to figure that out. And some are saying shut down the whole economy if necessary for COVID. And I think we're going to have a live experiment this fall as a lot of schools reopen. I think we're going to get to see how folks are doing, whether we see spread, whether we see increase in hospitalizations and death rates. And I think that might help us dictate what the right answer is going forward. But I think there is this balancing act of really addressing the issues, and it might not be dislocating everybody in the economy as we've started to see now. And you know, the numbers, I think, you know, could go up as we head into the fall. I'm not a doctor, and I don't want to... But just reading reports as people head back indoors, as folks are congregating in more confined spaces. And so those issues will have to get addressed. But I don't know if there's a, you know, one right or wrong answer. I don't think it's 100% one way or 100% the other to help navigate this one.
And I know it's nobody really knows. We're all just trying to do our best here. Jeff Moore, what does the Canadian dollar do under a Biden presidency, under a Trump presidency over the next 4 years or so? We have a weakening U.S. dollar. We saw it come up a bit a few days ago, but where does the Canadian dollar go from here?
Well, it depends. That's a good answer. So under President Trump, we get continuation mostly on the data. And so a lot of clients, if they're doing some forecasting of the Canadian currency, they're using some kind of time series model, which needs data. It's got data on President Trump. So let's assume it's President Trump, Canadian dollar, US dollar stays in this band. So we move to a President Biden. That's where there is not the data. There's the data on President Biden, which and Jim said who he is going back 40, 50 years in Paul and in the public eye. But then you've got the progressives in the party and so forth. And so depending on, you know, how a President Biden wants to run and how aggressive the progressive agenda, if it's an aggressive agenda, you can imagine there'll be more uncertainty in the United States around profits and things like that than in Canada. And so all else equal, you'd expect the Canadian dollar might want to do better. Okay, so keep that in mind that depending on November 4th, which country, Canada or U.S., has the most uncertainty around regulation, taxation, environment, you just, as the list goes on and on, the bigger the list, the more it'll be a factor for investors, corporate management teams, even public services. And so I would say that the Canadian dollar feels all right here.
Feels all right here, potentially. It's a really interesting point. I just think, you know, from where we sit, because it's been such a dynamic for Canadians looking against the US dollar all these years, always. Denise, can you just take us through this idea that there's sort of a reindustrialization of really probably of the world going on, but particularly the American economy, society, how that bodes for certain sectors?
Certainly, yeah. I mean, that CapEx is one of the critical drivers when you think about A, the market, and B, a shift towards cyclicality. So CapEx, capital spending, investment spending, you can chart it from government data, you can chart it from industry data. That has been a very significant corollary to both profits and stock market returns over time. And we haven't seen a real CapEx cycle, real industrial spending cycle in quite some time, because obviously we've been sort of offshoring for the better part of 20 years. So the question, or we don't know the answer yet, in terms of will this deglobalization push lead to a reindustrialization of America, and what might that mean? If history is a guide to this, it's mean one of two things, or maybe both things at once. One, higher actual profits. So profits actually tend to go up when CapEx is spent, because businesses invest in things that can generate higher returns, and two, higher market returns with that. The third thing that sector investors should understand is that what you usually see during this, let's call it CapEx recoveries or CapEx cycle, is a shift towards cyclically oriented sectors. So if you sort of stand back and look at the market in terms of sectors, you can divide it into two, I call them asset classes. Defense, which is consumer staples, utilities, healthcare to a lesser extent, the old telecommunication services. And that's because during times of recessions, you still brush your teeth and buy toothpaste, and you still go to the doctor and turn the lights on, versus those cyclically oriented sectors like energy, industrials, materials, consumer discretionary technology, financials, and I'll throw real estate in here as well. So that reindustrialization tends to disproportionately benefit those cyclical sectors with disproportionate odds in the industrial sector. So that, from a sector investment perspective, is the area to keep your eye on. And that's less sort of globally focused now than, say, the energy sector or even the materials sector. So the beneficiary is actually there.
That's fascinating. Jim, take us through a little bit the process in between the election and when the president is actually inaugurated. You've got these sort of transition teams. As I said, there's time for messaging in between there. What might the technology side of the world hear from either presidency on sort of tech regulation? Tell us where that stands right now.
Well, you know, I think we've seen that the tech sector under a fair bit of scrutiny in Washington, under data practices in particular, and information privacy and whatnot. You know, it depends who gets tapped to run the Federal Trade Commission. As you mentioned, there'll be a transition team. We'll look at who's tapped to lead those sectors. That's the opportunity for interested parties to submit sort of their position papers that make them their way into the policy binders that kind of become the guideposts for the next administration. And I think keeping an eye on who is at the, you know, who are these agency heads? So whether it's the FTC, Department of Commerce, or even if, you know, beyond tech to the banking sector, at the OCC, and who's the head of Treasury? Is it Elizabeth Warren? Is it Larry Fink? Is it, you know, we can only guess. We do know that the progressives in the Senate have had a history of blocking some of the more moderate seeming appointees. If I think back to Elizabeth Warren blocking Antonio Weiss to be an assistant secretary at Treasury, the administration found a creative way to bring Antonio Weiss in as a counselor to the secretary, so we can still see folks get through. But I think it was Elizabeth Warren who said personnel is policy, and so we'll start to hear names probably shortly after the election, in terms of who's in the running for some of these different posts, and might have a read on where the policy's headed at that point, but certainly before January 20th.
Well, we know we'll have to check back in with you, see who's sort of coming to the fore there. Jeff Moore, final question to you, and it's a bit of a forward-looking with the Federal Reserve. What do we watch for from the Federal Reserve, knowing that, again, this sort of fiscal package out of Washington, D.C., appears to be somewhat lacking to some? How does the Federal Reserve step in? Does it become more activist? Give us your thoughts on what we need to watch.
Okay, so the big thing for the Federal Reserve is right in front of us. The next FOMC, we're going to get more details on average inflation targeting. The bigger that agenda, the more expansive that average inflation targeting, and the more mathematical, and that doesn't mean anything to most clients yet, but it will soon, the more mathematical, the better that is for risk assets, okay, on net. If it ends up being more of what we've heard from Chair Powell at Jackson Hole, the virtual Jackson Hole, which was, hey, we're going to go to some version of average inflation targeting, but it's kind of whatever we want it to be, that won't be as great, but there's no negative coming out of that. And then I think what you're going to watch from the Fed, the Fed is told us that they're on hold until 2022. And depending on things like demographics, one of the big changes that's happened in the U.S., they're talking about there's 500,000 fewer births this year than in 2019, right? So this COVID will have long-lasting impacts on demographics for years and years in a lot of ways. And so you can imagine that the Federal Reserve, and this is bipartisan support, I think, the Federal Reserve could be on hold for an extraordinary length of time. And if they're not yanking up interest rates, it's really, really hard to get too negative on risk assets and the market in general.
I want to thank all of you. Thank you very, very much for joining us today. Jim Fibbio joining us, Jeff Moore and Denise Chisholm. Thank you for your time, your insights, and lots of checklists for us to be checking while we're watching the headlines. Thank you to all of you.
Thanks for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. Please visit fidelity.ca for more information on future live webcasts. Don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter and subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice.